This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 53. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, a podcast that helps developers be awesome in launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Mike?
So today I'm running a bit of an experiment, and you are the unwitting participant of that experiment.
Nice. What is it?
Well, right now we record our podcast through Skype, and as I told you before, I kind of switched over to using a MacBook Air instead of my Lenovo laptop that I was using. And I have Windows running inside of a VMware Fusion session inside of my MacBook Air, and right now I'm recording it through Skype and through Pamela, which we use to record through Skype, and all of that's being done on the Windows side.
Got it.
I've got the Windows virtualized, and Skype is running inside of it, and Pamela's running in that, and it seems to be holding up pretty well.
Well, cool. You still loving the MacBook Air?
Yeah. It's funny. I mentioned to you before that I had ended up taking it back to the Mac Temple, and they swapped it out for me. So this is actually my third MacBook Air that I'm on.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. It's crazy.
But you know what? Between the AppleCare and the warranty behind it, I mean, I'm not really out anything except for the trip to the Apple Store.
And they move your data and stuff, yep. Right? Yeah, so you don't have to do that. That's cool.
Yep.
Well, man, I have been knee-deep for, it's going on 2 weeks now, pretty much all day, every day, plus every night. I've been working late, and I'm just trying to revitalize and refurbish Hittail. I talked last time about acquiring Hittail.com. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where the app, it's been supported, but it hasn't been maintained. You know, it's been supported in terms of front end email support and such and fixing people's issues. But there's just a lot going on in the background that has kind of degraded over the years. And so I'm in the process of moving from the old servers to brand spanking shiny new server at another data center. And doing that is just an unbelievable amount of work. I did not anticipate it would take this much to do it. So it's involved, you know, since the database is so big, because there's millions and millions of rows. I mean, there's actually approaching a billion rows in the database.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, yeah. One table has 570 million. Another has, you know, a couple hundred million. Yeah, there's a lot of people using it, and there's a lot of incoming keyword data and referral data. And so the thing holds up well. Like, it doesn't, aside from hardware failures it's had, like, it doesn't crash per se. I mean, you know, it's doesn't have a bunch of bugs or anything in the code, but the database is just very large. And so my initial thing was, yeah, we'll just move the database across the internet. And the DBA was like, you're out of your mind. Like, you're going to have someone burn this on a, you know, on a USB drive and FedEx exit. And even then, we're going to lose, you know, one day, and then we'll have to set up replication. And that's what we've done. And I'm really happy that I hired a DBA, because I was going to try to do it on my own. And that would have just been a joke. Like, I probably would have gotten one day into it. It just wouldn't have worked. So although bringing the DBA in kind of like it kind of complicates things, because we do it the right way, it also means that it's going to get done right. Yeah, just 24/7, you know, doing that and staying up late, because we're doing maintenance stuff at midnight. Luckily, my DBA is in the UK, and so it works out for his work day. But I don't know. I just feel like I'm back to a crazy schedule, and it feels good. It feels good to focus on something for a long time. What's funny is when I say crazy schedule, yeah, I work 4 days a week, and I work, you know, 6 to 7 hours during the day, and then I probably work 3 to 4 hours every evening. So it's not actually, I mean, I think it probably winds up being 36 to 40 hours total. It's just that I'm packing it into 4 days and stuff. So yeah, it's really not that bad. It's not that bad. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying it's a shift for me, you know, to come. I've been working just a couple days a week for quite some time, so.
I have to make a confession, though. I didn't think that you worked nearly that much. I thought you put in like 20 hours a week tops.
Well, that's what I've been doing. Yeah, I've been doing 16 to 20 for about a year. And I made the decision when I acquired Hittail that I wanted to find something that I could be really excited about again. I kind of got bored, man. I need to be interested in something in order to be happy. You know, I think as entrepreneurs, that's a pretty common trait. Mm-hmm. And so just maintaining things was getting old. Mm-hmm. So that's the cool part. I mean, doing Hittail, it's more about like setting goals and attacking something that is hard and I plan to grow it bigger than I've grown anything. And that means it'll be a lot of work, but it'll be a good learning experience for me. I plan to learn a lot of stuff on the way. I'm not doing it for the money. I live off everything else I own. So like, this is not a requirement for me to live. And I think that makes it, you know, an interesting experiment. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm super excited about it. So hope I can keep the momentum up for 6 to 12 months that I think I'll need to turn it around.
That's cool.
So yeah. Speaking of AutoShark, how's it going?
It's going well. Last week, I implemented a mechanism for looking at the basic audit results that come out of it. So anything that you do and initiate from the server that gets executed on the POP service, it's a point of presence service that's running in the customer environment. Anything that goes through that gets piped back out to the cloud, gets saved. And I think I had that working last week. And now you can actually view those results and take a look to see what they are and where you were and weren't compliant. So it's very, very basic reporting at this point. I need to add in some stuff in the future to allow you to kind of cross-section and slice and dice the data. But so far, it's working well, and I've got a demo coming up for a company that's interested in becoming a reseller for it. So it's kind of exciting.
That is exciting. Yeah, your first demo after mm-hmm. beta, right? Yeah, that's cool. Cool. Well, let's see. The only other thing I had is there was a blog post. I published a post on my blog last week, and it was a guest post by Saba Yunus, who works for AppSumo. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, when she and Noah proposed it, it's called 10 Highly Successful Bootstrap Startups. And I was kind of like, yeah, mediocre. I mean, I was like, yeah, go ahead and do it. You know, I'll post it. But I wasn't that excited about it. And when I read the post, I was more excited. And then I posted it just figuring it would do average. And yeah, it has 200 tweets over the last week. And it's gotten, I don't even know, like 15 to 20,000 visits and just all kinds of stuff. So it really blew up, obviously caught the attention of just people who are interested in this stuff. So if you haven't read it, it's called 10 Highly Successful Bootstrap Startups. It's an interesting post. It's neat to read about. And it's not 37 Signals and who else? Woo Themes, or, you know, a lot of the success stories that we've already heard about. Most of them are companies that I either had never heard about or didn't know they were bootstrapped.
Did you make the list?
Yeah, right.
That's why I asked.
Neither you or I made the list. No. Nope. Our main segment this week is called How We Left Our Jobs. And it's kind of the untold story of how you and I moved from full-time employment into basically what we're doing today, and, you know, how we started our companies. And I think it's important to note, like, we didn't really want to go into all the grim detail of like our whole history, work history, all that stuff, because I don't think that's important. I think what people really like to hear in these kinds of stories is the emotion and the thought process and what we were thinking and how we went about doing it, maybe some mistakes we've made and successes we had along the way. So I think we'll probably do it like with a little bit of an interview style, so that, you know, one guy isn't just talking the whole time and the other person is kind of asking questions now and again. So I think we dive right in. It's a bit of an experiment, but I'm hoping that folks enjoy it.
I think that one of the first businesses that I actually started was while I was still in college. And I went to RIT in upstate New York. And as part of the program for my degree, I had to do 5 quarters of what they refer to as co-op. It's basically work experience while you're still taking classes. It counts towards your degree. At least in my program, we were required to have 5 of them. So it was basically 15 months worth of work experience in order to finish our 5-year program. So you technically you're spending a little bit under 4 years on your classes, but then you've got this extra 1.25 years tacked on to your degree to help you get you some work experience. And what that does is it kind of guides you to figure out what sort of things you're actually interested in working in your field. And it also looks great on a resume. The place that I had done a co-op at, one of the IT guy that I was working with, he owned his own company building computers. And I kind of latched onto him and used him as a bit of a sounding board to create my own company doing basically the same thing, only I was doing it in Rochester and he was doing it in Buffalo. And that was kind of my first business experience. And I did that for probably 3 years.
And did you do that while you were in college or while you were a salaried employee?
Both. Well, I mean,
okay.
It
ran into the employee.
Yeah, I was a salaried employee, but I was paid by the hour because I was a co-op student. I was working there full time, and I was, you know, building these computers on the side. And then in the in between times when I was going back and taking classes, I was still running the business and building computers for people. So yeah. I made decent money at it, though. I mean, I was making anywhere from $200 to $400 per computer that I was building for people. And I would do a lot of, I mean, everything was custom. So if somebody wanted a new, you know, a special video card for something that they were doing, I mean, I did a lot of gaming systems. There were people who were really interested in flight simulators and things like MechWarrior, where you almost needed like the SLI that was kind of big back then, where you had these graphics accelerator cards that, in addition to your regular video card. I just happened to know a lot about that stuff because I was interested in it, and it helped me build all those machines for people who wanted to do that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then I just got bored with it. Not necessarily a lot of manual labor, but it was enough labor that my profit margins were probably a lot less than they probably should have been. And I just got bored looking through magazines and looking at pricing sheets and searching online because, you know, this was back before 2000, before Google was really around and started making it easy to find prices of different things online. And, you know, people weren't really publishing their prices for all their stuff yet. It was still a lot of going through magazines and calling people and saying, hey, how much is this?
So that makes sense. You started it and you get bored of it. I think that's a pretty common thing. I've had that happen as well.
So I just decided to shut it down. It was an official business registered with the state. And I just basically waited and for about a year or so before I went to the state and said, look, I'm just shutting this down. Because I wanted to still have the business around if somebody came back to me for some sort of support or something like that. I just canned it. I just walked away.
Yeah, it's a tough business, right? It's like low margin. It doesn't scale well. Like it's all a ton of labor and the tiny, tiny margins because there's so much competition. So you probably, I know there was a little more margin back then, but obviously not a business that had much future for you in terms of building and support, building a life, you know, kind of supporting yourself from it.
The margins went down dramatically. It was back when Dell was absolutely terrible at what they did. So they would put out a machine and it would tank after a week or 3 weeks or something like that. And it was constant. So I saw that at the place that I was doing a co-op at. And I said, look, I can do better than this. And so I did.
What'd you do after that?
After that, I went and worked full-time at Wegmans Food Markets in Rochester, New York, and I was a programmer analyst in the IT department working on a pilot project for selling groceries online, and that was interesting. I had a lot of fun there. I lasted there for about 2.5 years, and I worked there while I was working my way through grad school as well, so I was working full-time and then taking either part-time or half-time classes at RIT to get my master's degree. You know, I got to the end of my degree and I had met my future wife while I was taking grad classes because she was getting her Master of Fine Arts at RIT as well. And then she said, well, you know, I'm done with classes and I want to move back to Massachusetts. So we just decided to move to Massachusetts together. There, I lasted at Wegmans for 2.5 years or so. And I got to the point where I just kind of felt like I needed a change. They ended up taking the pilot project that we were on and canceling it, not because it wasn't doing well. The fact was that people enjoyed shopping in the stores as opposed to actually ordering their groceries online. And so they just said, no, we're not going to continue this pilot program anymore. And they moved me off into the logistics department, which, as you can imagine, is not exactly the most thrilling thing in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not that interesting. It's the kind of stuff that's really cool. Like if you're a junior developer, you learn a ton. But doing that for 5 or 10 years is just mind numbing. I can't imagine that you would want to stick around very long.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, there was a really cool project they ended up putting me on. It was a voice recognition system for their warehouses. So the warehouse workers could go around and talk to these little headsets and it would interact with a database, then tell them where to go, how much of the stuff to get. And from the end user's perspective, it was probably not necessarily very interesting. But if you look at it from a what did it accomplish standpoint, they increased their throughput pretty quick. And I went over to the seafood warehouse where I implemented it the very last week that I was working there. And they increased productivity by something like, it was about 100% in literally a day.
Nice.
It was ridiculous.
Nice. So you left there after your wife finished college, grad school. Where'd you go next?
Then I moved out to Massachusetts. I got a job at working at a startup company called Pedestal Software. And I worked there for probably about 2 years or so. It was about that time that the company had gotten acquired by Altiris Corporation, which is a publicly traded company. And they got acquired for around $65 to $70 million.
Right. And we've talked a little about this before. People are probably familiar with it. Were you a developer there? Or were you? Okay. So you're writing code. Cool.
They hired me as what they refer to as a custom engineer, and that was essentially somebody who could come in and could pick things up quickly and learn quickly, but I didn't necessarily work on the core of the product. What I worked on was a lot of ancillary stuff that was associated with it and shipped with it, but wasn't necessarily core components of the code. So like I did very, very little C or C++ or any of that stuff. The vast majority of the stuff that I wrote was in this custom scripting language that was shipped with the product that was executed by the core of it. I think I literally touched the code once because there was something weird that was happening where if a line was more, if it was longer than 10 kilobytes long, it got truncated and we couldn't figure out why. And I found in some place in the code where it said it just arbitrarily declared a 10 kilobyte array. And if it read more than that, too bad, it just truncated it.
Right, right. Cool. So your one production fix, hooray! So that one production fix means you got like 10% of the gross when the company sold?
No, you know what? I didn't even fix it though. That's why I got zero.
Oh, nice. You didn't get zero. You got like 0.0008, if I recall.
Yeah, it was something like that.
Right, right. So and you went straight from there to consulting.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yep. There was a company that was based right in my hometown where I was living. They said that they needed somebody to come on and do consulting. They were actually looking for a full-time employee, and it turned out that I was a little bit too expensive for them. So we worked out a deal where I wasn't an employee for them, but I would do work for them for this specific project. And they had a six-month contract, and they put me on this contract. And I worked for that contract for about 3 months or so. And then the customer ended up pulling the plug and refusing to pay. So that was not a fun experience, but I was able to get a job less than 2 weeks later because of my contacts at Pedestal Software. And then I went and did some consulting work for the former VP of sales and marketing at Pedestal.
So Pedestal, you were salaried, you're 9-to-5-er or whatever, 9-to-9-er, depending on how much work you had, but you were getting a paycheck every week. Then you left, they were acquired, and you decided to leave, which makes sense. You said it wasn't fun anymore, right?
Yep.
So your next move is into consulting. Was it scary to say, I'm not going to get a salary, you know, I'm only paid by the hour, I don't have healthcare anymore, work could dry up at any time, all that stuff? Or were you mentally, you're just like, ah, screw it, I'm throwing it to the wind?
I wouldn't say it's as big a risk as, at least for me, it wasn't nearly as big a risk as you phrased it as, because my health benefits, I was getting them through my wife at the time, because being on her health plan was actually more cost effective than being on mine at Pedestal. So that didn't really make a difference. And then in terms of thinking to myself, just throwing it to the wind and saying, oh, I'll give this a shot and see what happens, I basically had kind of the promise of 6 months worth of work. And I was being paid significantly more than I was at Pedestal. I mean, I was basically being paid twice as much.
Right.
Which is great, but at the same time, you don't necessarily have the guarantee that you're going to get a paycheck. But as you and I have talked about before, I mean, that guarantee of a paycheck is really an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
You're lying to yourself if you think that that's a guaranteed paycheck from now until you decide to retire. The thing that I didn't really realize was that although it was a six-month contract and it was intended to be a six-month contract, the big mistake that I had made was that in signing that with the company I was doing subcontracting through, I didn't get paid unless they got paid. And they
You've talked about this. Yeah.
They promised to pay me within 7 days, but I didn't think through enough to say, well, what if the customer doesn't pay?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that sucks. So you had no money, no paycheck basically for 3 months of work.
Yeah. I got paid for, I think, the first 2 weeks. And then the next 12 to 13 weeks, I didn't get paid for, which was fine because I still had that $8,000 from Pedestal. Mm-hmm. And I think I was making $3,000 or $4,000 a week and doing consulting from them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that right there was going to carry me for a couple of months anyway. So I wasn't real concerned about it until I got the phone call that says they've canceled the contract. They're saying that, that we're not doing what they wanted and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, we've been showing it to them every single week. He's like, I know, there's nothing I can do. And that's when I went out and decided, okay, well, I've got to get a new consulting job. And I was able to get one very, very quickly within a couple of weeks. And that was kind of what I'd banked on initially when I ended up leaving Pedestal. I said, well, I'm pretty good at what I'm doing and my abilities are, I think, at a very high level. And I knew enough people that I said, well, I can probably get the work that if I really, really need it. And I was able to.
What made you continue doing consulting and not look for a salary job at that point?
It paid a lot more, to be perfectly honest.
Because I've gone through that same, or I don't do it anymore, but I probably 3 or 4 times over about 6 years, I went through that decision of whether to go back to salary job or get consulting. And so I'm interested. So for you, it was the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. That's a good reason to do it.
Well, I mean, you think about it, and sure, you don't necessarily have that job continuity, or maybe you're not at the same place every week or whatever, but if you have a salary job and you're making maybe $100,000 a year or something like that, if you're doing consulting, you're good at what you're doing, I mean, you can easily make 50% more or 80% more. I mean,
yep.
It's a huge difference. And you can start taking off not just this 2 weeks that most people get every year, but you can take off 3, you can take off 4, you can take off 5. I think last year I took off 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that was basically including holidays and stuff. I barely took any time at all. And this year so far, it's September. I think I've taken 5 weeks off so far.
Right. So. Yeah, see, I always had a problem. I had a hard time taking time off when I was consulting because not only did I have to pay for my travel and stuff, because typically I take time off, we travel, but I wasn't making my whatever $100 an hour for all that time I was traveling. And that was like painful to me. And I thought about it a lot. And that's one of the reasons I didn't enjoy consulting that much, was because I monetized my time in my head, and I had a real hard time doing things that I felt like were not productive.
Yeah, that's one of the big problems with consulting, is that you're either making money or you're losing money.
Yeah.
That's just the way that it goes. Although I do consulting, and that's how the business that I own makes money, I still get a paycheck. It's not like I get paid when I work and I don't get paid when I don't work. I get a paycheck every month, no matter what. It's just a matter of making sure that the business has more money coming in than it's coming out.
Right. You started a consulting firm, right? You went from being a one-man shop to hiring employees and such.
Yep. So I had a 2,200 square foot office and separate offices for everybody, because back in the day, I mean, I was reading Joel on Software, and that was kind of the thing to do. And I was looking at trying to transition from a consulting company into a software company. And it never really worked out that way, because in 2008, that's about when the economy tanked, which meant that everybody cut back. And the first place that they cut back was consulting. So my consulting business completely tanked at that point. And I could keep myself busy, but I couldn't keep the other guys who were working for me busy, because the problem was that I would come in and I would explain, oh, these are all the things that we can do for you. And they would say, yes, we want you to come in. And I'd say, okay, I've got this great person to do it. And they said, no, we want you. Okay, well, that doesn't really help my business. It ended up backfiring on me, my ability to come in and present and do those sorts of things. And people would say, we want you. We don't want some other person who, we don't want a bait and switch. We want you. It just happened that way. There wasn't a whole heck of a lot I could do about it. So then after that, I laid everybody off. I got rid of the office. I basically redid my basement to make that into a home office, and decided that I wasn't going to scale out a consulting company. And to be perfectly honest, that was a hard decision to make. It was hard to say, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I think that that's partly because you look at it and say, well, I failed at this. I could also look at it and say, well, I learned that that wasn't going to work. So it just depends, I think, on your frame of mind and how you think about it.
Yeah. How did it feel? You build up this firm, and then you see that it's not going to work, basically, and you have to lay everybody off. And obviously you had a lease. You probably ate money on that. You know, there was a big swing. You had a bunch of money in the bank, and then it swung way down and you were in the hole, basically in debt. Like, what was going through your mind during that time? Were you like depressed, or were you pissed off, or were you just like, ah, whatever, this is business and I'll dig myself out?
I was thinking that I would dig myself out. And I think the reason for that was because I had run into the same general situation probably 3 times before that, where things were going down, and then I'd end up with a big sale and things would be way back up. And I felt like that was just part of the cycle. And it wasn't until I was probably 6 or 8 months in with having very little income versus all the expenses that were associated with it, when I started really digging around and looking and saying, well, wait a second, this has gone a lot further and faster than I thought it did. And at that point, it's too late. I mean, there's really nothing I could do about it. I mean, there were a couple times. I think my largest sale was about $170,000. And it's just, you know, you get that in one shot and it's like, boom, $170,000. And it was an $80,000 profit on that sale. So when you end up getting those kinds of numbers and you start getting used to that, those are the terms that you're thinking in. And I'm looking at the book saying, okay, yeah, things are going down, but all I need is one sale. And boom, right. $80,000 profit margin, and you know, things will be fine. And right. I don't think I really realized the magnitude of what was going on until it was too late. I mean, things had already gone way past the point of recovery.
Yeah, that's tough, man. The reason I asked that question is because, as you know, I'm pretty risk averse. And the reason is if I had that big swing, I think I would have completely freaked out. Like, I would have had so much anxiety about it. And I would have, of course, said, well, I'll dig myself out. But I would have just been, I would have been really, really stressed about it.
Have you been in a situation where the deals that you're getting, maybe you're only getting a couple of them at a time for any of your businesses, but the price point is extremely high?
Yeah, not really. Yeah. Not like you're talking about, no.
Right. I mean, when you're looking at those sorts of things, it only takes one, and that
right.
that pendulum can swing quick.
Right. No, that makes sense.
So, and those are the things that I was looking at, and I was pursuing these deals that I thought would come in. And like I said, I just didn't realize how bad things were until I got to the point where I'm like, oh my God, I don't know if I can make payroll in mm-hmm. another month or 2 months or something like that. And it was just, you know, it's too late at that point. You can't just say, okay, well, I'm going to take the guys that I've got and focus on building a product, because you're not going to be able to build a product, put it out there, and start making enough money from it in this course of like 6 or 8 weeks to be able to support 3 or 4 people full time. It's just right. not going to happen.
Right. So these days, you're a one-man show.
So
high profit margin, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because I've just got myself to support. So yeah. I can buy whatever I want. I don't necessarily have to worry about where the money's coming from or how much money I'm spending on it. Like the MacBook Air that I got, I just decided, you know, my laptop was dying. I said, oh, okay, I'll just go buy a new one. And I don't have to worry about benefits for other people and HR stuff. I don't need to worry about hiring. And if a customer says, yeah, this sounds great, we want you to come in and do it, no problem. It makes things a lot easier. Like I said, my profit margin is much, much higher with just one person as opposed to me doing consulting and then trying to manage somebody else as well.
Right. If things are good, why are you screwing with perfection and going off trying to build apps, do that? Because obviously there's more here than we can really tell, right? During this same amount of time, you acquired an app for me. I think you launched an app on your own. There were other things going on that we just don't have time to talk about. But why do you keep going after the product?
There's a couple of different reasons. One is because I'll be honest, I like writing software. I do. I think writing code is fun. And a lot of the consulting that I do is not necessarily writing code. So I would prefer to get back into writing code. But the other thing is that it scales a lot better. I certainly make a decent living doing consulting, but I know that if I can write some code that gets out there and starts doing well, then I could make considerably more money for less time and less effort. And at some point down the road, I can just say, look, I just want to sell this whole thing and check out. And at that point, I can do whatever I want. But I also know that when you're doing consulting, you're tied to somebody else's schedule. And that's what I really don't like. I prefer having my own schedule to work on stuff. So I'll give you an example. It was about a month ago. I took 2 weeks off. And during those 2 weeks, I worked on Audit Shark. And I just said, you know, I'm going to work on this. I'm not going to, you know, work on anything else or worry about customers or consulting or anything like that. And sometimes I would get up early and sometimes I would get up late. And if I had something to do in the middle of the day, I'd just go do it. I didn't have to worry about, oh, I've got to be in Vermont for 5 days and now I've got to be in Utah for 5 days and then I fly home. And I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. I mean, if you're working on your own products and, you know, assuming you don't have an office, you can you work on your own schedule. If the inspiration strikes you at 9 p.m. to do something, you can just go do it. If you don't feel like it, you don't have to.
Yeah, that feeling is unbelievable to me. It is incredible to feel like I'm in control of my schedule. I have thought sometimes of like, I have a hard time remembering what it was like to work under someone else's rules and to go into an office every day. And it makes me shudder a little. I think I would curl up and die if I tried to do it now after having been out of office, you know, cubes for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's so much to be said for that. Like, you already have location independence. You mm-hmm. could kind of move wherever you wanted to, right? Because you're either going to do stuff remote or you're going to fly to a client's site.
Right.
And I had that for years as well as a consultant. You know, I could move wherever I wanted. And that I thought that was a really big deal at the time. And it is a big deal. But when I realized that I didn't have time independence And which is exactly what you're talking about. It's like you have to either be in an office, you know, be in Vermont, or you have to be around between 9 and 5 while, you know, even if you're coding from home in case someone calls you and to do, you know, meetings and all that stuff. That is a big deal. Like, I think people underestimate how much work it is to have clients and to still not be in control of your time, even though you can work from home. It's a big difference.
Right. And I think that that's the second piece of it, the time independence. That's really, for me, the motivational factor. I mean, I think that you mentioned it initially. You experienced the same thing when you first started doing consulting. You could live or work from anywhere, but you're still kind of tied to somebody else's schedule. And I just don't want to be tied to somebody else's schedule. And that's really kind of what's driving me at this point, is because I want that, not just the location independence, because I could do what I do from anywhere right now, but I want that time independence at this point. And I've come to realize that it's the time independence that I want, not necessarily just the location independence. All I need is an internet connection, and I can do just about anything I want or anything I need to.
Right.
You said that the time independence is really big for you. I mean, there had to be something that kind of started you out in that direction. I mean, what started driving you in that direction? Where did you come into things?
You know, I actually have a good answer for that, and we will revisit this question in the next podcast.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.